I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, the Associated Press is calling the Justice Department's secret seizure of some of its journalists' phone records unprecedented. Here's the AP's executive editor, Kathleen Carroll, on MSNBC this morning.
We're distressed that the Justice Department felt the need to seize our records and not tell us about it. I've been in this business more than 30 years, and our First Amendment lawyers and our lawyers inside the AP and our CEO is also well-known First Amendment lawyer. None of us have ever seen anything like this.
Last Friday, the Justice Department sent a letter to the AP announcing that it had seized 2 months of 2012 phone records. Yesterday, the AP sent a letter of protest back to Attorney General Eric Holder. New York Times reporter Charlie Savage has been following this. And Charlie, the seizure appears to be because of a story the AP reported last May?
Last May, the AP broke a story that there had been a foiled bomb plot out of Al-Qaeda's Yemen affiliate to blow up an airliner with another one of their underwear bombs. And there was sort of a cascade of leaks about that story. The first one was the AP that said that this had happened, and they had held on to that story for several days at the White House's request because of ongoing intelligence operations. And then within a day or two, it subsequently came out, not from the AP, but in other sources, that, including the New York Times, I should say, that the way the plot had been foiled was through a double agent. The suicide bomber was actually a Saudi agent who had infiltrated the group, and thus there wasn't someone out there still waiting to carry out an attack with a bomb. And that second leak about the double agent really led to uproar in Congress amid a backdrop of a lot of disclosures of national security information in the press. Attorney General Eric Holder announced a special investigation into the leak in June, and now we see that part of that investigation is looking at the original revelation through the Associated Press that there had been such a bomb plot and that it had been foiled.
Well, we want to be clear. The Justice Department is not saying that its investigation was tied to this leak, but people are assuming that it is because of the timing. But tell us more about how people are reacting to this now as opposed to how they were reacting to it then.
Well, there's an interesting political shift afoot. A year ago, one of the reasons Attorney General Holder announced that this U.S. attorney in the District of Columbia and another one in Maryland would lead high-profile leak investigations was that the administration was coming under a lot of pressure from Republicans in Congress to do more to crack down on the leaks. And the narrative then was President Obama was running for re-election on his counterterrorism credentials, the killing of Bin Laden, and so forth. And his political opponents were saying that he was leaking sensitive information, thereby endangering national security in order to look tough. The White House denied that, and there would be calls for Attorney General Holder to go further than these investigations, to appoint independent special counsels, the big difference being that the Justice Department would have lost control in that case, and he didn't do that, and almost 30 Senate Republicans co-sponsored a resolution calling for an outside special counsel and greater independence. That was the environment in the summer and spring of 2012. In 2013, things are almost 180 degrees different. The narrative now is Republicans talking about the Benghazi affair and the IRS probe of Tea Party groups. And yesterday, after this revelation, a lot of Republicans in Congress, like John Boehner and others, came out denouncing this as Watergate-like, going after reporters. So that's a sort of interesting shift in the political dialogue about these leak investigations.
It's also interesting that the Obama administration has taken a very aggressive stance. No matter what you think about it, the Obama administration has indicted twice the number of government officials for leaks than previous administrations combined. That also is something that's come out since then. Just very briefly, though, Charlie, can you sum up what the Justice Department, what we know about what the Justice Department did? Did they follow procedures to get this information? Did they abide by existing rules?
Well, under normal circumstances, the regulations for the Justice Department call for subpoenaing reporters or their telephone records only as a last resort, doing it in the most narrowly focused way necessary, and usually to give advance notice to the news organization, and the Attorney General himself has to sign off. So here, Eric Holder hasn't said yet whether he signed off on it. Here, the AP had no advance notice, 2 months' worth of records, and there was no opportunity to contest that in court. Now, the regulations do allow them to make an exception if advance notice would somehow disrupt the investigation. But to date, we've not had any explanation of whatever the rationale was for why such a long period of time of records and no advance notice was given in this particular case.
As Jeff Zeleny is reporting on ABC, a White House official said to him yesterday when this story came out, Benghazi, IRS, the AP. Is it just Monday? So it's going to be a kind of a busy week for the White House.
Indeed.
Charlie Savage of The New York Times, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Preventive mastectomies are back in the news. Movie star, mother of six, and UN Special Envoy Angelina Jolie wrote that moving op-ed in today's New York Times, revealing that she recently had both her breasts surgically removed and reconstructed. And that prompted a disclosure from CNN anchor Zoraida Sambalin that she's also going to undergo a double mastectomy.
I was diagnosed with breast cancer about 3 weeks ago, and I was trying to figure out how do I share this story, how do I tell the viewers that I'm going to be gone for a while because I've chosen to have a double mastectomy. And so Angelina Jolie's story really hit home.
Well, as we heard, Jolie already had cancer, and we wish her well. But Angelina Jolie does not. She had her breasts removed after she found out that she carried the faulty version of the gene BRCA, or BRCA1. She was tested because of a family history, including her mother, who died of breast cancer at the age of 56. So today's news is starting conversations, as it did with Jolie, and raising questions, again, about double mastectomies. In a moment, a doctor from the Mayo Clinic, but first, a 40-year-old North Carolina mother of two, Marla Dansky, who also has the BRCA1 gene and has scheduled a double mastectomy at Duke University in August. Marla, your thoughts on hearing this news today from Angelina Jolie?
Well, my first thought was it's wonderful that somebody who so many people will listen to has spoken up, and that with her encouragement and her sharing of her experience, that it will encourage so many women to go and to get tested and to get more information about what their options are.
Yeah, we have a CNN anchor who doesn't know she had the gene but is having the procedure. It's really become a conversation. I understand your mom had a reoccurrence of her breast cancer last year, and her doctor advised you that you should get a double mastectomy. Tell us about that conversation and what you thought then.
That conversation, my mother's team said, since your older daughter, my mother has two daughters, has already had her children, and knowing my mom had tested BRCA1, had tested positive, that they advised that I might want to remove both breasts and also have a radical hysterectomy. And at that point, I was kind of taken aback and said, hey, before anyone, you know, who's never even examined me starts deciding to cut things off me, I think we need to look into this a little bit more.
Do I understand you said, well, I'll get a mammogram?
So that was my response was, I'm sure I'm fine. Let me go get a mammogram anywhere you doctors can pick where I have it, just to prove to you that I'm fine and that you can all leave my body parts alone. So 3 rounds of mammograms and 2 rounds of ultrasound later, they had scheduled 3 biopsies for me, and the biopsy found a cancerous mass in the left breast and also cancer in the lymph nodes.
Yeah. It might have felt too strong at the time, but those doctors were right.
Yes.
So you had the mammograms showing that you had cancer, but then did you also get tested?
Yes. So at that point, I had my genetic tests for BRCA 1 and 2, and it's really quite simple. It's actually you rinse with mouthwash and spit it into the container, and then it gets sent off to the genetics lab. And then 2 to 3 weeks later, you get the results back.
And?
And in light of the results that I was BRCA1 positive, I made the decision to go with a double mastectomy and reconstruction. And then also at that time was introduced to a separate oncology team that deals with ovaries, fallopian tubes, cervical issues, and also removal of the uterus.
Yeah. So you're having, a lot done. You're 40 years old. You have 2 children.
Mm-hmm.
How are you feeling about all this?
I feel very good about my team. I have a fantastic team, which is very important when you're being treated. And also, I'm confident that by taking these additional steps, that we're going to do cancer. We're going to do it once. We're going to do it right. And it's not going to be an issue that's going to have to be dealt with again.
Mm. I understand that your sister, it was also tested. What is she doing?
She tested positive for BRCA1. She, at the time, made the decision not to do anything yet because she had not had her children, and she has still not had her children. Unfortunately, with everything that was happening with me, my mom insisted on her having a mammogram, they found a cancerous mass in her right breast. And she will now be undergoing double mastectomy to handle that situation and also to prevent development of cancer in the breast that doesn't currently have cancer.
This is tough because it so concentrates in families. And I guess, I circle back. I'm sure it's not your first consideration, but it does seem like to have someone like an Angelina Jolie and other women coming forward, at least it extends beyond your family. It becomes a community.
Yes, that's true. And the more people talk about it and the more people raise awareness about it, the bigger the community of people who are getting taken care of and who are surviving and living long, healthy lives becomes.
That's Marla Dansky. She's being treated at Duke University Hospital in North Carolina and has elected to have both breasts along with her ovaries and cervix removed after detecting cancer and the BRCA, BRCA1 gene. Marla, thank you so much and best to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, we have a lot of questions. If you do too, send them to @hereandnow.org. And while we bring in Judy Bowie, Associate Professor of Surgery at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, Dr. Bowie, Angelina Jolie, Marla, both deciding to have these double mastectomies. But Marla, as we noted, has cancer. Angelina did not. There was a lot of controversy over double mastectomies as preventive measure. How common is that now to have them before cancer is detected?
I think increasingly women are seeking out this information, and as we see increased awareness among physicians and among women in the community about the prevalence of the BRCA1 and 2 gene, people are more seeking out to consider genetic testing.
Yeah.
If we look back 5 or 10 years ago, women were very concerned about genetic testing, and now I think society is much more open to kind of empower the women with decisions. And so for these women that we see in a high-risk breast clinic who have a family history of breast cancer or anything that has kind of brought them to see a physician to question how high is my risk of breast cancer, we would do a strong evaluation of their family history and then try and evaluate how likely it is that they may or may not carry a BRCA1 or 2 gene. And then we would discuss with them whether they are interested in getting tested. So, you know, some women want to know the information and some women would prefer not to know whether they're tested. Some families, a woman may be tested and her sister may choose not to get tested. So it's still a very personal decision, and the decision really lies with the woman herself. And then once a woman does get tested, obviously if they test positive for a BRCA1 or 2 deleterious mutation, then we have clearly identified that they are at a higher risk of developing breast cancer.
And then another decision again. That's Dr. Judy Bowie, Associate Professor of Surgery at Minnesota's Mayo Clinic. We're going to take a break and much more with the doctor on the other side of the break. Again, if you have questions, please send them to hereandnow.org. We'll ask them. We're hearing that Angelina Jolie said her risks of cancer fell from 87% to 5% after her double mastectomy. We want to ask the doctor if that's standard. And we will in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to our look at double mastectomies in light of Angelina Jolie's disclosure today that she had one after she detected the BRCA gene, a signpost for cancer. We're talking to Dr. Judy Bowie, Associate Professor of Surgery at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. And Dr. Bowie, pick up where we left off. Angelina Jolie writes that her risk of cancer fell from 87% to 5%. Is that standard after double mastectomy?
So a double mastectomy decreases your risk of developing breast cancer by about 90 to 95%. And the real question among women is, what is a average woman's risk of developing breast cancer? For a BRCA1 or 2 carrier, we anticipate that the risk of them developing a breast cancer falls in the range of 56 to 87%.
That's high.
So if you say the average range is 56 to 87%, and you decrease that risk by 90 to 95%, you're dropping it to below 5%.
Yeah. And we also heard from Marla, who's also having a double mastectomy. She already has cancer. And she said she hoped that Angelina Jolie's disclosure would encourage women to go out and get tested and find out if they have this. But is that a good idea? I mean, who should get a test? Who pays for it? What do you recommend?
So on average, about 1 in 500 to 1 in 800 women carry a mutation in the BRCA1 or 2 gene. So it doesn't mean every woman in the nation needs to go out and get tested. It is important to reflect on your own personal family history. The women that we think are at the highest risk of carrying a gene and the ones that we tend to refer for genetic testing are those patients who have a family history of breast cancer, especially if it's in a first or second degree relative, such as a mother or a sister or an aunt, and especially if that family member had it at a young age, if you have two or more family members, and any male breast cancer in your family is also kind of a red flag to consider for genetic testing, and then Ashkenazi Jewish heritage. So we look at kind of breast cancer, ovarian cancer, number of female relatives, how close they are in the family tree to you, what age they were when they developed breast cancer, and then Ashkenazi Jewish descent. Yes. So it's looking at the full family history to guide the likelihood that a BRCA gene may be responsible for the breast cancer in that family.
Well, one of our listeners, Samantha, is pointing out that Angelina Jolie's mother actually died of ovarian cancer. What is the connection between a double mastectomy and other cancers?
So with the BRCA1 or 2 gene, these patients are known to be, as we said, a 56 to 87% risk of breast cancer, but they also have about a 15 to 44% risk of ovarian cancer. So for these women, it's important to discuss with them not only their breast cancer risk, but also their ovarian cancer risk. And so options available to them, a bilateral mastectomy significantly decreases their risk of breast cancer, but really does nothing to impact ovarian cancer risk.
No.
The other alternative would be a removal of the ovaries, bilateral salpingo oophorectomy, where we remove the ovaries and also the fallopian tubes. That decreases your risk of breast cancer also by 50% and impacts your risk of ovarian cancer. And some women would opt to do both. Some women would opt to do one or the other. Depends a little bit as well on whether your family history and your personal experiences and where you are with child's birth and your preferences.
So a lot of personal decisions. We're also reading that part of what's factoring into women's decisions today, as opposed to maybe 10 years ago, is improved techniques for breast reconstruction. Angelina Jolie describes a procedure which saved her nipples, used her own skin to rebuild her breasts. And we know that an association of surgeons just met recently in Chicago and talked about a lot of these advances. So what is there new to know?
I would very much agree that the reconstructive options and the different methods for performing a mastectomy have evolved a lot in the last 5 to 10 years, and this is definitely something that is making a bilateral mastectomy far more palatable for women who are considering this approach. So for women who don't have a breast cancer and at an elevated risk because of a BRCA gene, often we would consider a bilateral nipple-sparing mastectomy, which preserves all of the skin envelope of the breast, preserves the patient's nipple and areola, can often be done through a relatively small incision that can be tucked either in the inframammary fold under the breast. And often just a single procedure, we can do a bilateral nipple-sparing mastectomy with an immediate reconstruction at a single operation, kind of a one-stop shop in many institutions. And patients walk out kind of with reconstructed breasts. I mean, I tell my patients that they can walk out in a white T-shirt and no one will necessarily know they had a mastectomy, as opposed to 10 years ago where you had that body image change where you lost the breast and everything was flat, and that psychologically was a lot harder for women to go through.
Yeah. You know, I want to back up to something that we raised, but I'm not sure we fully took in, which is who should have this, which you addressed. But then if a woman decides to have the double mastectomy without a doctor telling her she should, in other words, she's tested, she's got the BRCA gene, maybe she has no family history, but she's still concerned. In other words, there's not as much pressure from the doctors on her to consider this, but she wants to do this because she wants to take the most preventive steps she can. I guess I'm asking, are there cases in which a woman might elect this, but the test and the surgery might not be picked up by insurance? Because we understand the test alone can be $3,000 if it's not covered.
Right. So the BRCA testing costs about $4,040. The majority of insurance companies cover it. But usually on their websites, they have pretty clear criteria in terms of the family history and what the risk factors are. And then if a woman does elect to undergo a bilateral mastectomy, especially if they have a strong family history or if they have a mutation in the BRCA gene, the majority of insurance companies do cover both the bilateral mastectomy and the reconstruction.
Yeah.
So I think the important message here is that women should choose what they want to do, and then, you know, let the business office at the institution work with the insurance companies. But I would say the majority of my patients are very successful in getting coverage for this procedure if this is the way they elect to go.
That's Dr. Judy Bowie, Associate Professor of Surgery at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. I know if people still have questions, please send them at hereandnow.org, or you can join a Facebook conversation, facebook.com/hereandnowradio. Just very, very briefly, Dr. Bowie, your thoughts on Angelina Jolie's disclosure today?
I think it's having a great impact nationwide. I mean, from our standpoint, we see women who are facing this decision every day. I think the important aspect is that it is still a very personal decision. We have a lot of patients who have a deleterious mutation in the BRCA1 or 2 gene who elect not to undergo a bilateral mastectomy. So consider all the options and make the decision that works the best for your personal preferences.
But the conversation has started once again. Dr. Bowie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Latest news is next. Here and now. Among the dozens of hunger strikes at the U.S. Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay is a 44-year-old Shakar Amer. He's the last British resident in the camp, held there for more than a decade without being charged with any crime. The BBC's Farhana Dawood reports on his case.
Who am I? My life. My freedom. Both taken away on Thursday, 14th of February, 2002.
An internet video made by the Save Shakar campaign. Shakar Amer has been imprisoned at Guantanamo Bay for 11 years without charge. His wife is raising their 4 children alone, but as her father, Saeed Sadiq, told me, waiting for Shakar's return is taking its toll.
At the very beginning when he was captured, he offered if she wants to divorce her, but she refused. She said, no, I live without you and wait for you. And meanwhile, in 11 years period, so many times she fell ill, mentally very disturbed, very disturbed. Waiting, 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 it is very difficult, very hard. Sometime whole night she was crying in the bed. Because this life is neither die nor live. Should be done something.
I met Saeed Sadiq at the office of Jane Ellison, the family's local Conservative Member of Parliament. She recently led a parliamentary debate on Shakar's case and is at a loss to understand why he is still being detained.
Our argument all along is of all the people in there, surely the most obvious person to release as soon as possible is someone who is wanted back by the government of a trusted ally with whom we share intelligence at the highest levels and who is willing to have him back and which has an excellent track record of resettling former detainees. To me, it's just an obvious first step if the president is serious about closing Guantanamo.
Shakar Amer was one of the first foreign terror suspects taken by US forces when they entered Afghanistan in 2001. It has been alleged that he was a member of the London branch of Al-Qaeda, recruited fighters, and received payment from Osama bin Laden. He says he was working at a school in Afghanistan.
He was actually captured by sort of Afghan warlords and actually sold to American troops.
His lawyer is Clive Stafford Smith.
The Americans haven't charged him with anything, so it's not like they're holding him because he's committed a crime of some sort. Indeed, he's been cleared twice, in 2007 by the Bush administration and much more thoroughly in 2009 by the Obama administration. So no one is saying he's committed any crime. And I have challenged MI6 to put up or shut up, I mean, to tell us if indeed they're submitting material to the Americans to justify his detention. Naturally, what MI6 does is refuse to answer. And MI6 has a motive, and the motive is that Shakar is a witness against them. I've known for a long time and have got through the censors the fact that when Shakar was being tortured in Bagram, there were MI6 or British Secret Service agents present.
Those allegations that the British Intelligence Service, MI6, are holding up Mr. Amer's release for reasons of protection from prosecution were also raised by Jane Ellison in Parliament. The Foreign Office Minister, Alistair Burt, said the government had acted to make the security forces more accountable. He added that compensation had been paid in cases of wrongdoing and said there was no part of his government that was holding up Mr. Amir's release.
I'm aware of these allegations being made, and I want to make it very clear that all parts of government are pulling in the same direction for Mr. Shaka Amir's release.
The US Department of Defense won't discuss Mr. Amir's case with the BBC, but said in general security assurances were required from the country of settlement before a detainee could be released. Many US lawmakers feel the prison should stay open, that the detainees are too dangerous to hold on the US mainland, and that suspects should only be tried before military tribunals. Congress has imposed several restrictions on the release of inmates. All military spending, including the transfer of prisoners away from Guantanamo, must be approved by them. And the US Secretary of Defense must certify that an individual detainee would not engage in terrorism or act against the United States in the future. Under this political climate, no inmates have been released from Guantanamo Bay over the past year.
The BBC's Farhana Dawood. Take a break. When we come back, we'll check in with NPR's Code Switch and have our Aki homage here and now. There's new research that shows a record 7 in 10 Hispanic high school grads enrolling in college, 2% more than their white counterparts. Further, the study from the Pew Hispanic Center shows Latino high school dropout rates have been cut in half over the past decade. But while Latinos are entering college in greater numbers, they're not finishing in greater numbers. What's going on? Hansi Lo Wang covers race and ethnicity for NPR's new initiative, Code Switch. Code Switch meaning more than one language in a conversation, but NPR is extending it to mean more cultural awareness in general. So, Hansi, tell us more about this research on Hispanics in college. Big deal?
This is a big deal. We're talking about a large and young demographic group that's too big to ignore. It's going to grow. Latinos currently make about 1 in 6 of Americans today, and in 2060, they're going to be 1 in 3. And I talked to one young Latino woman, Sandra Martinez. She works at the Maryland Community Center. She's 30 years old. She supervises a group of Latino students, and I told her about this report, and this is what she had to say.
College, I think most of us Latinos, we think that it's not for us. I would say for me, when I was younger growing up, that was never mentioned. There was no more higher dream after high school. And I think that now the kids becoming more Americanized and whatnot, it's helping.
So she sounds like she's representing maybe the most recent generation before this one that's going to college. She's going to college later.
That's right. She's going to college later, but the students that she's working with, they're thinking about college right now or hoping and planning to. And this shows that there's a long-term rise in Hispanic students going into colleges.
Yeah. So she's 30 and studying for her bachelor's and working with younger people. So why is there increased enrollment in college for this newer generation of Hispanics? What are the factors there?
Well, we don't know for sure. The Pew Hispanic Center report did not get into the why, but there are some theories. And I talked to the co-author of this report, Richard Fry, and he thinks that partly it's because of the recession that a lot of high school graduates are finding it harder to find jobs, and that includes young Latinos. But there's another theory about why more young Latinos are heading into college, and I spoke with Marcelo Suarez Orozco, dean of UCLA's Graduate School of Education, and he thinks there's a very clear and compelling reason why this is happening now.
I think the story here is really the story of the maturing of the second generation. These are U.S.-born kids, and they're kids that have higher ambitions. They want to do better than their parents, and they're connecting with colleges.
But there's a couple of questions that are raised, and you mentioned that the recession might be driving young Latinos to school as opposed to jobs because unemployment has gone up 7 percentage points for young Latinos, compared with 5 for young whites. And so they may be looking at schools for that reason. But what kinds of schools are they choosing? Because we understand they're not necessarily choosing the 4-year college, choosing it less than their white counterparts do, less likely to be enrolled in college full time. And then that disturbing statistic, less likely to complete school. What's happening there?
There's a little bit under half Latino students who are currently enrolled in community colleges. And what we're seeing for students that do go on to 4-year colleges, which of course is ultimately the goal for any student, they're more likely to drop out than other students, and they're less likely to attend selective 4-year colleges. And what's happening is these Latino college students are facing a range of challenges, many that a lot of college students are facing. One of them is that college is a big financial investment. And I spoke with Jacqueline Lizama, a current high school senior. She's Latino, 18, planning to go to community college this fall. And she says that that investment she's about to make is something that some of her Latino classmates may not be able to.
They want to get a better education, but they're thinking about the money. Oh, my parents can barely do it now. How am I going to pay off a loan if I get a loan? How am I going to do it?
You know, and that's a question that a lot of college kids have, regardless of color. But as you've been pointing out, this is the first generation going to college, so maybe they don't even know what the question should be. So how does that get handled when you're the first generation to go and you're gobsmacked by these loans and this money and don't have a role model?
This is a very common problem for a lot of first-generation college students. And I went to that community center I mentioned earlier in Maryland, and it's part of a range of different nonprofits that are here right outside Washington, D.C. in Maryland. It has one of the highest Latino populations here, so that's why they're here. And they're trying to address this issue. And I spoke with Sandra Martinez, who we heard from earlier, and she said that she sees herself playing an important role as someone who currently, even at 30, is currently enrolled in college, trying to get her bachelor's and her master's, trying hard to overcome these challenges, and something that she thinks that she can help role model for these students.
I've been there, done that. If I know that I did it and it was possible for me without the guidance of my parents, of anything, it's possible for them.
Again, another voice gathered for us by Hansi Lo Wang with NPR's Code Switch initiative, which, again, as we said, is, as we go full circle, is to bring awareness of different cultures. But if I am not Hispanic, why is this important to me? Obviously, this is profoundly important to the Hispanic community to see this first generation go to college in such big numbers. But why is it important if you're not Hispanic?
You know what? Let me give this answer first to Professor Suarez Orozco at UCLA, who addressed this directly.
They are the future of our country. This is not a narrow demographic question pertinent to only one group in the American mosaic. This is fundamental to all of us.
This is fundamental because right now we're seeing the baby boomer generation, which is predominantly white, starting to retire right now. And they're going to be replaced in part by Latino workers. And if today's Latino students are underprepared to join the workforce because they're not heading into college or they're not completing college degrees, that's not going to bode well for our economy or for the country.
That's Hansi Lo Wang. He covers race and ethnicity for NPR's Code Switch team. There's a link to this new research at hereandnow.org. Hansi, thank you so much. Look forward to your future stories.
Thank you, Robin.
So, raise your hand if you went to sleep last night right before one of the greatest comebacks in sports history.
Pas moi!
With the help of our Canadian colleague and hockey player Karen Miller-Medson, a recap of last night's last-minute Boston Bruins win over the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Magnifique!
The Bruins trailed the Toronto Maple Leafs 4-1 with 11 minutes left.
Is that a fini?
But while I fluffed my pillow, they scored 3 goals to tie, 2 in 30 seconds.
Bergeron with a high shot and score! Bruins have scored to tie the game!
Incroyable.
Then another in overtime to win.
Sacré bleu, Patrice Bergeron from Quebec, my hometown.
So the Bruins survive to the second round of the NHL playoffs, where they meet the New York Rangers.
Quelle horreur.
Until then, we enjoy another instant classic.
Patrice Bergeron is my new BFF.
To read more and to see Karen suited up for our Here and Now Office Olympics, go to hereandnow.org.
Now Marchand with it. Hands it off. First one is a rebound chance in front. Taking it to Sam. Puck comes free. Score! Patrice Bergeron, who tied the game, has won it in overtime.
And I know it's weird. Karen's Canadian and a Bruins fan, but it's against the law to be anything else in Boston. Back with Chef Kathy Gunst in 1 minute, Here and Now. Spring is now well underway, which has Here and Now's resident chef Kathy Gunst thinking spring green, as in asparagus, artichokes, peas, even green rhubarb. Now, since 1947, the U.S. government has considered rhubarb just a fruit, but don't tell this to Kathy Gunst. She joins us in the studio with her latest spring accessory, her own asparagus.
Absolutely.
You're the only person I know who accessorizes with vegetables. You can walk around with them.
I walked out of my car. I have before you an orange plastic cup with a tiny bit of water and 4 asparagus spears in them that I picked at my friend's farm about 2 hours ago. When an asparagus has just come out of the ground, people are like, doesn't make a difference. It's not like a tomato. I would like you to eat one raw.
Okay, I will. Because,
it is such a treat, and it is so different than eating one that's been shipped from California.
First, what I'm going to do is snap it.
Exactly.
I mean,
yeah,
come
right.
on.
And you're going to get juice, and you're going to realize that you can eat these things raw this time of year when they've come out of a garden or you're finding them at a farmer's market.
And should you snap the bases off?
Absolutely. The way that you trim the end, the root end of the asparagus, is by snapping like the bottom inch off, and they'll naturally break, just like you did.
Yep, yep.
So that's usually the tough part. But if you ate that right now, 2 hours out of the ground, you wouldn't believe how tender it is.
I have been. I'm going through them. And another question for you. I once heard you're supposed to cook them upright.
I never have done that.
No?
It's just, you know me, no fuss. Like, I just don't want to have to get another piece of equipment. You can go to fancy gourmet food stores and find $40 asparagus steamers where it's upright, you know, kind of coffee can shape. But do you need to go buy another piece of equipment?
No.
Asparagus are plentiful this time of year. You want to be cooking them a lot.
Well, give us some recipes.
Okay, so I do want to just go back to, you just trimmed off the ends.
Mm-hmm.
Don't throw those out if you're not going to eat them and they're that fresh. Make a gorgeous vegetable stock. Throw them into a pot, cover with water, add a leek or an onion, some pea shells, maybe a carrot. Simmer it for an hour. You'll have a beautiful vegetable stock. But asparagus, my absolute favorite way to cook them these days is to roast them. So I trim them, I put them into a small little roasting pan or an oven-proof skillet, little olive oil, little salt, pepper, and maybe a grating of lemon zest, 450 degrees, really hot. And you take them out while they still seem raw-ish, because they're going to keep cooking in that hot, hot pan. And then you can serve them hot. You can have them with a vinaigrette as a salad. I can't get enough of these roasted asparagus. You can also use that as the basis of a soup. After they're roasted, throw them into a blender with that vegetable stock we just made. No cream, no dairy. Spectacular.
Okay.
I also have a wonderful salad where you take the asparagus raw and you add steamed edamame, which are soybeans. This is the thing about this time of year is you are so ready to shed. Like, I just put away all my winter coats, right? What a great feeling in New England when you shove that down jacket into the back closet.
I know, but you live in Maine. You should keep it out.
I have sweatshirts. But I mean, it's just, you want to start eating differently. This is just a whole new body awareness in the spring. I'm not talking about diet. I'm talking about craving green.
So we'll have all of this at hereandnow.org, but let's move on to artichokes. Now, you know, this is the thing that looks prehistoric, like some sort of the dinosaur of vegetables with scales on it or something.
You know, I have thought so long and hard, who was the first brave soul to take a look at that with those spiky leaves and think, oh, that's something we could eat, you know? Who knew to eat these things? But once you get inside an artichoke, there is the heart. Mm-hmm. Finding the heart, it's worth all the work. I finally learned just this year that, yes, they're delicious steamed and you can chew on the leaves and dip them in butter the traditional way, but you can also just cut them all away, get to the heart. We're going to have a video that shows you this. Mm-hmm. It's an incredibly simple technique. And then you have this beautiful heart where you can just braise it, you can boil it, you can steam it, you can roast it. And it's really the part of the artichoke everybody wants.
In fact, you have braised artichokes for us, and you have a chicken with braised artichokes, leeks, and chives recipe. What's the one thing, and you can just pass those artichokes over
here. I thought you might. I might get your attention with those.
What's the one thing we should know about braising artichokes?
Not to do them too long. You don't want them soft. You'll see those still have a bit of a bite. Mm-hmm. So I braised those in lemon water and a little bit of olive oil. And then I roasted some asparagus spears and I tossed it all with olive oil and lemon juice.
You know, we should probably hear this from your lips. What does braised mean?
Braised means simmered in a bit of liquid. It's not swimming in liquid. It usually comes up about halfway to the food. So if you're braising chicken or artichoke hearts or asparagus, it's just a little bit of liquid and you spoon it over the food. So it's kind of a more gentler, slower way of cooking and it keeps food very juicy.
This is...
Isn't that fresh?
Delicious. Yeah, crunchy, and then it's got the lemon. Ooh.
So you'll notice we braised the artichoke hearts, but we didn't make them mushy or falling apart. If you've only had artichoke hearts out of a can or a marinated jar, hello.
Yeah.
You have something very exciting about to happen.
Same with asparagus. Well, let's move on to peas. A few years back, you made us a wonderful summer soup made out of peas and lettuce. We'll have that at hereandnow.org.
I did. English peas, which are also called shelling peas, those are the ones where you have to open the shell and take out the actual peas. Those are the shells you want to make your vegetable stock with. And those peas are fabulous, stir-fried, steamed, and thrown into salads. They're delicious raw. Then there's the sugar snap pea, which is in between. It sometimes has a string. It's crunchier, very sweet. Again, delicious raw or traditionally used in stir fries. The other thing is if you have a farm near you or you're growing peas, the pea tendrils, the beautiful, delicate green leaves on the outside of the plant, the Chinese use them. It's called daomyu, and you stir fry those with fresh ginger and canola oil, and that is a real delicacy of spring. And it doesn't kill the plant, but here's this beautiful pea green. You'll see them in stores now also. Ask for pea greens.
Well, and now, Kathy, for our big finale, rhubarb.
So the first thing you're going to think is, wait, rhubarb's not green, it's pink. But this time of year, these huge elephant ear-like leaves are popping up out of the ground, and they're very green. And what will follow is this beautiful pink and green streaked stalk, and that's the rhubarb. Is it a fruit? Is it a vegetable? Take it up with the government, right? But rhubarb's just appearing now, and it is so good for sweet things, obviously pies. It's often paired with strawberries. The biggest problem with rhubarb is because it's so sour, people think they have to add gobs of sugar. And I say don't. The whole point of rhubarb is that it's tart and it wakes you up and it's just this bracing spring flavor. So don't add as much sugar as your recipes tell you. Try and pull back and I think you'll see. I brought you a upside down rhubarb cake.
Okay.
It's made with orange juice, so it's on the light side, and it's got cardamom and allspice and ginger in it. Mm. And you taste that tart rhubarb, but it's not overly sweet, and I think it's a nice honor to rhubarb in the season.
Wonderful.
I also wanted to say that you can use rhubarb in savory dishes. I chop it up and I add a little sprinkling of sugar. I'm talking about maybe a tablespoon for a pound of rhubarb. And I put it on the grill in big stalks and it softens. And if you're a meat eater, serving grilled rhubarb with a pork chop, a grilled pork chop, or a piece of grilled fish, totally blows your mind because you only think of rhubarb as a sweet fruit /vegetable.
Wonderful. We've been talking all things spring green with Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst, also author of Notes from a Maine Kitchen. We'll have all of these recipes we were talking about at hereandnow.org. And I now have to finish my cake. Goodbye.
Enjoy it, Robin.
Oh, back so soon? The cake awaits. We know, musical cliche, but we just had to. It just screams spring. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.